She was a maiden of extraordinary beauty. When my eyes, which had suffered so much I lost my senses, faintly opened, the first sight I saw was her. Her glossy black hair was tied in a man's topknot, and her crimson chiramen undergarment slipped from one shoulder. Days later, to pick blossoms on Mount Io, she led me gently by the hand. We slipped from the Hot Spring Inn, with its vermilion-railed tower, through the back door into the moonlit dawn, emerging onto a paddy path. She was dressed in a chugata yukata, with a satin obi, carrying a single sickle wrapped in a towel. Meanwhile, when she emerged from the white crone's house, holding me upon her lap, her hair was styled like a Karawa knot, her chest adorned with jewels, a celestial maiden's guise. She rode in an ox-drawn cart, passing through a clamoring crowd, as villagers took turns, raising their parasols high, joining the procession. At the village edge, we paused at a temple, where she changed her attire, ignoring the many voices murmuring, "Thank you for your hard work. Thank you for your hard work." The maiden gently rubbed her cheek against me, whom a young man carried on his back. Then, crossing the slope of Ishidaka Road, she entered the Ichibanya, the tallest house among the lively row of two-story dwellings. I was merely faintly moaning, a whisper in the quiet. Indeed, I slept 3 nights at the White Crone's abode. Even then, the maiden would go out and return, letting me rest my head upon her lap. I vividly remember, with a hint of bitterness, how she constantly fended off the gathering horseflies. When carried by the celestial maiden in the cart, surrounded by many people, by the Koshin Hall, a tall old man stood upright, half hidden by a hazel tree, apart from the crowd. He watched us intently. I felt sure he was the one who had stripped me of my clothes, but as a child, my condition was too poor to even speak. I still wonder if that noble, radiant person was a god or a Buddha. Thinking back later, it seems most likely she was the old woman's daughter, who had been working at Shimizudani Hot Springs. For the festival, the village youths borrowed her, parading her through 8 or 9 villages, shouting, "Behold this!" Perhaps the maiden might have been a bathhouse girl. V. Then, I was laid down in a beautiful small sitting room which seemed to be her own. Whenever I woke, whenever I wanted, whenever I felt thirsty, whenever tears came, that maiden never failed to show her gentle face. One evening, when I felt my illness had recovered, she took my hand and led me down the long, shimmering corridor to the bathhouse. We bathed together in the translucent hot spring, and after thoroughly rinsing our bodies beside the stone-carved tub, she took out a comb and gently combed my hair, 2 or 3 strokes. Then, from the bathhouse rock, she held the comb up to the corridor light, gazing intently with a noble profile. She said, "Ah, how wonderful! Not a single beautiful hair has fallen out, and no dirty insects are attached." I too felt moved and gazed at the comb with her, but I had never seen my own skin, or any body, as clean, white, and beautiful as it was then. I was dressed in new clothes, and the maiden, still in her pink obi, took my hand again. This time we ascended to the second floor via the back ladder. As we reached the top of the stairs, a room at the landing, seemingly newly added, had no fusuma, revealing a white floor. There, the moonlight sharply pierced the space. All the rooms on both sides were dimly lit, in the quietest depths of midnight. "What a beautiful moon indeed," she murmured, and taking my hand, we stepped onto the floorboards. There, a small window awaited. It also had no shoji, so when we both peeked out, dew streamed down the roof tiles in front, like molten silver running. The moon had left the mountain ridge. Half of it was dark, but the pearl-crowned peak was clear and bright, as if the water had cleared. When I asked, "Which mountain is that?" she simply replied, "It's Mount Io." Just then, a fox cried out sharply, and the maiden tightly embraced me, pressing my forehead against her chest. I unknowingly burst into tears. "It's not scary," she said. "No, it's not fear I feel." Then she spoke of her mother's illness. Gazing at such a clear moon, I wished to pick those brilliantly red flowers and bring them home, thinking for the first time, "If it's this person," I confessed and told her. She was silent for a while, her gaze fixed, looking at my face. She said, "A flower of true crimson in the moonlight. We shall surely find it." And added softly, "Yes, yes, with a woman's devotion." The next evening, she woke me up late. Naturally, I was already awake and waiting. We quickly got ready. At that moment, she tightened her obi firmly. And as I mentioned earlier, she had one sickle, its blade tightly wrapped in a towel. Then, we secretly exited through the window where the moon had shone last night and descended onto the tiled roof. A ladder was hidden among the entangled leaves of the moonflower. We climbed down into the garden, swung open the back gate's lock, and stepped out. Before us lay the foot of the mountain in the faint light of the waning moon. Mount Io was clearly visible, as if close enough to touch. But this was the mountain's secret, rear side. There was no path up from there, so it seems we went around to Tomuroguchi and climbed. Well, before reaching the sacred mountain we aimed for, we slept two nights at Tsujido. After that, how did we come? Each time fearsome figures, terrifying beings, appeared blocking our path, the maiden shielded me behind her. She would hold up her sickle, standing tall and resolute, as reliable as an armored Himagami, a goddess of strength. Then the path would open up, like clouds disappearing, and we would advance steadily. Kosaka heard a sound, like fabric being torn. He looked up and saw a woman standing. Her figure was half hidden by tall grass, up to her shoulders. As she moved her hands behind her, a sharp sickle, like a polished gem, appeared and vanished in arcs. Its blade rose and fell with each careful, scooping cut. From the tall kogon grass, bundles, each an armful, were swiftly cut and laid down. The hidden earth slowly revealed itself with each step, guiding her path in measured increments. 5, 3, then 1 foot. Kosaka, struck with awe, instinctively raised his hand. He bowed his head in quiet reverence, just as the woman had done for him. Thinking he might be troubled by his sudden halt, the flower vendor glanced back gently, saying, "My dear, just a little more now." "Please," Kosaka replied, his voice now cautious. "Are those flowers still found on Bijogahara? Such a deeply moving tale. Please tell me the rest quickly. And were those flowers there back then?" "The flowers were indeed there, but you always go to Bijogahara, so you must know, no? When I go, I will search for them with you, just as that lady did. Still, I intend to wait for the moon to rise. Once that flower basket is full, you can return before nightfall." "No. Usually when I travel alone, I'm used to it and think nothing of it. But now with company, I feel too lonely to go back alone. I will wait with you until you return. In return, please help me with the flower basket." "Of course, that goes without saying. And where, pray tell, were they found?" "It felt like a dream, I suppose. Along the way, we met with shadowy obstacles. The girl seemed moments from being stained with blood, and I, seized and killed. I cannot count how many times I thought that. Then, as twilight settled, we arrived at Bijogahara, an area of about 8 square cho, shaped like a fan's paper. Flowers bloomed everywhere, filling the sky and the ground. We both knelt there, hands clasped, just as the girl did. When the moon rose, it became so simple. Among the peonies right before our eyes, a single petal shifted its form. One blossom, deep crimson, was all there was. When I picked it and held it to my forehead, the girl, overflowing with joy, stroked my head and wept tears. She said, "You must never forget this feeling, not until you die," and tried to place it in my hair. But my hair was unbound, so the girl instead placed it in her own dark locks. Even as a hair ornament for her, its color remained deep crimson in the moonlight. My mother's grave illness, we had to hasten, so we quickly left Bijogahara behind. On our way back, we descended effortlessly, without hardship. Soon the crow of a rooster heralded the dawn. How joyful to think we were close to human dwellings. But as the moon set and morning darkness lingered, four or five men approached from the distance, torches blazing. Mistaking them for friendly faces, I eagerly approached. But they were all sturdy, rough men. Among them, I recognized a face I'd seen before. It was the horseman who had tethered his horse at old Kuroba's house. Seeing the two of us, the horseman suddenly cried, "Don't let them escape!" He seized me under his arm. The other three or four men grabbed the girl, who cried out, "Hey!" Where we ran, how, in what direction, for how long, it was all a blur, a dream. When I finally came to, the girl and I were together, sitting in a corner of a large room, surrounded by seven or eight men, including the horsemen, facing ancient sliding doors of unknown centuries. With a floor like bare wood behind him, sat a man cross-legged. It was none other than that formidable old man who had crossed Naruko's ford, standing like a guardian deity. Seeing the dazed faces of us two children, he threw the kimono dyed with seasonal flowers from the other day, right before our eyes. Then he laughed, a wide, open-mouthed laugh. "Ah, I like you both. Let the boy become my son and the woman his mother, and never return to the secular world." The girl, her hair disheveled, still holding the flower, rested her hands on her knees, her head bowed in silence, as if to coerce an answer from her. For 2 nights, above the earthen floor, I was suspended in a cage, hung from the terrifyingly high attic. They offered rice balls wrapped in paper, but how could I eat such a thing? Through the gaps in the cage, I saw the girl. A bonfire on the dirt floor lit her face, pale as snow. She was bound. I saw her. Then my vision blurred, and I saw no more. When the cage finally thumped onto the dirt floor, 5 or 6 mice scurried out. In their place, the girl came in. She chewed a fragrant medicine and passed it to me, mouth to mouth, held in her lap. I clung to her with all my might, but her hand reaching around my back felt as if it touched empty air. She seemed like the hollow shell of a cicada. In just 2 nights, she had wasted away to a thread. I will never see her again. Please let me keep that flower-dyed kimono as a memento. But I have an obligation. You must never say there's a hidden house like this here, even when you return to town, she cautioned me, her face so pale. Then the palanquin was carried away, and I drifted in and out of sleep for 14 or 15 cho. A voice said, "Madam, we are here." When the palanquin was set down, someone took my hand and led me out. Kneeling on either side, supporting my hands, was even the horseman. As someone carried me on their back, the daughter emerged from her palanquin to bid farewell, her face hidden behind her sleeve. Then, with a gasp, she collapsed, weeping onto the long shaft. That was the last time. Kosaka's voice grew clouded as he said, "The man who carried me left me far off by the base of Suzumi Bridge, beyond the village and across the river, then returned." This man seemed mute. He uttered not a single word throughout the long journey. I felt as if the dead had come back to life when I finally returned home. Exactly 3 months had passed since then. When I placed the flower by her pillow, my mother, who had been on the verge of death, began to breathe again. She gradually recovered day by day, passing away 5 years later. Some say she recovered due to the joy of a child returning from a supernatural disappearance, but I believe it was the healing power of the medicinal herbs that girl gathered for me. Even now, I can't help but think of her as my benefactor. Though I knew, even as a child, that the girl had been captured by bandits, I returned home, strictly warned not to speak. So, when the great bandit gang, notorious across 3 provinces, broke into our next-door neighbor's house, I remained silent, saying nothing. Yet later, a lead emerged. It was discovered that the vicious bandits were holed up in a mountain temple, built like a fortress of rock, deep in Futamata, at the foot of Tomuro. Back when they still called them Rasotsu, many constables surrounded their hideout. Then, right in the center of the main gate, appeared the old man himself, they say. 6 feet tall, stark naked, with tightly bound gaiters and straw sandals. On his back, strapped crosswise, was a floral-dyed Noshime crest kimono. Its flowing sleeves fluttered wildly in the mountain wind, and a woman's black hair cascaded down. He gripped a long, heavy spear in his hand. If the woman on my back isn't already a corpse, I'll pile up mountains of the dead. I'll forcefully make her a living flower, bury her amidst the blossoms of Mount Iyo's Bijogahara, and return her to a makeshift funeral. If you come near, you'll forfeit your lives, he roared. He scattered 5 or 6 who approached, and as they hastily retreated, he burst forth, leaping from rock to rock again and again. He eventually leaned on his spear, vanishing behind a rocky outcrop, and that was the last of him. Ah, so that was it. After that, on the birthday that marked my departure to meet that girl, I would come to Suzumi Bridge, bow in this direction, and then return home. But from the year after my mother passed, I went to Tokyo for my studies, only returning to my hometown just last year. I had always hoped to climb this mountain to search for her traces. But amidst all my distractions, I've been incredibly self-indulgent, with no excuse. And now it seems I need that medicine once again. Before, it was for this very reason that a rare woman sacrificed herself for me. This time, I will not shy away from any hardship, no matter how great. I desperately need that flower. As he spoke, his chest tightened, and it wasn't just because of the tears welling up in his eyes. Suddenly, he realized the woman's figure was gone as if she had vanished due to the tall grass. He plunged through the Kogon grass taller than himself, pushing it aside with his shoulders, ducking his head. With no way to speak to the unseen person, Kosaka took out his sutra scroll and reverently held it to his forehead. Mountains and rivers, steep valleys, where profound life is born. Herbs and medicinal plants. All trees, great and small, fields of grain, sugar cane and grapes, all nourished by the rain, abundant without fail, dry lands deeply quenched, healing trees flourishing. From those clouds emerges a single pure essence of water. Sunbeams pierce through the thickets, casting a bluish shadow on the sutra scroll, like moonlight on grass. As he gazed and walked on, flashes of crimson appeared, then yellow, then fading violet, then passing white, like playful butterflies, marking the verse with scattered colors. They were already the mixed blooms of all 4 seasons. Suddenly, the heavens opened. His body was enveloped in clouds, and a wondrous fragrance filled his sleeves. All he saw was like piled snow, pure white, with flashes of crimson, green reflected in his dazzled eyes. Swiftly, they separated, one by one, becoming petals and leaves. The flowers of Bijogahara, fragrant in Kosaka's sleeves, bloomed within his heart. The flower vendor set down her basket and stood resting. She removed her sedge hat, revealing her long, slender neck. Her lustrous black hair was tied high, and somehow, a small flower adorned it. Her kimono hem was slightly askew, the edge of her sleeve brushed. She stood amidst large, white chrysanthemums, waiting for Kosaka, smiling gently. Her face was beautiful and noble, her commanding eyes fixed intently upon him. Kosaka hardly recognized her as the woman from his story. With a gasp, the student realized he had already forgotten himself, forgotten his name, feeling like nothing more than a child of 9. Well, engrossed in conversation, you've arrived late, so the moon must be visible soon. Please help me pick flowers for the basket before then, she said, as if relying on him. Kosaka, however, simply nodded in obedience, as if serving a deity. He picked chrysanthemums with his left hand, peonies with his right, plucked bell flowers from the front, and gathered morning glories from behind. All the while, he recounted once more the Suzumi Bridge, the Naruko Ferry, the dike's evening shower, the black crone's fresh tofu, the white crone's grilled eggplant, the ox cart's celestial maiden, the moon at the hot spring inn, the sharp sickle on the mountain path, the bandit's dwelling, and the parting at Tomoroguchi. By the time he completed one full cycle of stories, the flower basket was beautifully filled. Then, the basket, flowers and all, seemed to sink into the blossoms and vanish. As the moonlight shone, he bowed reverently, wholeheartedly, peering through the shadows again and again. He looked, he searched, but only the fragrance took shape, a faint illusion. Clouds, snow, and violet hues all blended into the colors of the night. Just as he was about to collapse in despair, he unexpectedly saw them standing side by side, hands clasped gracefully, a single flower in her black hair, crimson in the moonlight. It goes without saying that Kosaka prostrated himself at her feet. Then, shoulders softened, the beauty took his hand. He, taken by her touch, knelt close, his face rising to her obi. Bathed in moonlight, she gazed intently with her gentle, mature face. A slight tilt of her cheek, hair falling gently. A subtle hand held it back as she pulled a hairpin. She tucked it into the trembling student's collar, lost in bliss. Then her eyes stirred. Ah, so dear, she whispered. The illness of your beloved will surely be cured by this. Alas, Kosaka's hand, holding firm, found only empty stems. His sleeve now empty. Bijogahara remained in full bloom, swaying gently forward, and her form drifted away. He tried to stand, to follow, but peonies bloomed heavily on the rocks, to a peak, like a great white elephant's head. It rose suddenly, as if entering the clouds. Her distinct eyebrows appeared for a moment. Then the field was still, windless under the moon. Kosaka sat down, resigned, with the red flower in his breast as a bookmark. He placed a sutra on a nearby peony bloom, a foot wide. He clasped his hands in prayer and recited the Yakubon chapter through the long night.